Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 51, and we'd like to thank you for listening. This is kind of a special episode. Jason is actually in tomorrow. It's Thursday evening for me. Jason, it's Friday morning for you in Geneva. How's it going?
Good, you know. Yeah, it's weird to be straddling 2 days. Yeah, I'm craving good coffee. You know, I've been here for a week, and I got up this morning. It's about 8 a.m. here on Friday, and I thought before we talked, I think you're having whiskey and I'm having coffee here.
I'm having both to stay up.
I ran down the street to get a coffee because I don't have any in this Airbnb that I'm in. And it's like, you know, I just can't get good coffee in Geneva. I just can't wait to get home to like make a good AeroPress or a pour over or something. But that'll come.
I mean, so much of these shows, all you get is an espresso.
Exactly. Yeah.
I like Nespresso perfectly fine. I have one and I kind of bounce it between that and the AeroPress, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
But I mean, you go to these shows and after about the 20th Nespresso in 2 days or 3 days, it really starts to feel like acidic and not at all like coffee.
Yeah, yeah.
And you start thinking like there's a reason that Nespresso like puts this as a shot and not like four or 5 ounces.
Right.
It's just you just put it down and then you're awake for a bit and you move on to the next thing.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah, but I'm wrapping up here, so I'll be flying out tomorrow morning, and I'm quite happy to get home. But one more day,
and that's great. And SIHH, what did you think this year? I don't even know really where to start. I obviously wasn't there. I dealt with a huge amount of FOMO. You know, that's the fear of missing out. And you know, it looks like everybody had a really good time. All the normal cast and crew were on site in Geneva, and I actually think there were some pretty, at least noteworthy watches. But I actually think there are a couple ones that like are good, like good, and I would aspire to own. So I'm excited to see what you thought, you know, having been there. So please.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it was some good watches. I feel like the industry's turned a corner a bit. I think watches are, you know, SIHH in the past couple of years has been such a show all about, and rightly so, about, you know, the really high-end stuff and innovation and watchmaking. But I was always a little bit disappointed not to see some, you know, good solid sort of TGN worthy sports watches. And this year there were a handful of really good things, and we can chat about it in a bit here. But you know, for me, the show is, as you remember from last year, you know, it's more about seeing people, and whether it's the folks from the brands that, you know, being out in Minneapolis, mm-hmm. or you in Vancouver, you know, we just don't get to see them as regularly as the people that live in New York, so that it's nice to see them. And then the, you know, the usual cast of characters from, you know, Analog Shift guys were here, Jacob and James, and Ted Gashu. Got to chat with him, and you know, the whole gang from Hodinkee, and some of the Gear Patrol guys that I haven't seen for a while, Red Bar guys, and then I bumped into a guy, his name is James. He's a co-owner of Astwood Dickinson in Bermuda, who I met like on an America's Cup trip a couple of years ago, and he was playing darts in a pub, and I bumped into him. So, you know, for me, these are the memorable experiences. I mean, you know, the watches are kind of a fleeting, quick try on the wrist, take a couple photos and move on. So, but yeah, we can certainly jump into the watches.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's split it up between watches. And if, you know, I think you went to a couple cool dinners, you saw some celebrities.
Let's, you know, I mean, I think you and I both probably are going to overlap on some of our favorites from the show. The one that was announced prior to the show, one of them that was announced prior to the show, I think that was a hit for Baumann Mercier, was that Baumatic mm-hmm. watch, which isn't exactly TGN material, but the price is right. And it's, you know, if you're someone who's in for a nice dress watch, you know, $2,700 for a nice little 40 millimeter steel watch with the movement chops that watch has, is really impressive. And that's kind of Baumann Mercier's, I guess, bread and butter are the kind of entry-level affordable stuff of all the brands here. I don't know if you saw that, if that appealed to you, but it has that almost, it almost has like a geophysic
aesthetic
going
for sure.
It with the crosshair dial.
It kind of has the same sort of philosophy as the geophysic as well, where it's into the, it has that nice aesthetic, that kind of proven, reserved sort of Swiss, simple aesthetic.
Yeah.
but it has a couple of nice feature points, a nice bright dial, you know, applied markers. I think a pretty good date window.
Yeah.
I really like that the depth of the date window's very thin, so either the dial's very thin or the movement and the case and everything are nice and tight, so you don't get that big shadow.
Right, right.
And I know that's really picky, but I've started to get really tired of date windows, especially when you see some watches that just flat out don't have them.
Yeah, yeah.
And you realize, like, from a design aspect, it's just great.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I like the Bowmatic, and I like, you know, it's a white dial with a white, you know, date display. And then on top of that, you've got a bunch of silicon elements in the movement. And this is going to be a shared movement.
Yes.
Among other Richemont brands. I believe it actually shows up. I at least read online that it shows up in some form in the new Panerai, which we can talk about in a moment.
Yeah.
Maybe as the base movement that they went that way route. But look, it's under $3,000.
Yeah.
It's steel. It's 40 millimeters. And it has a high-tech movement. It's not exactly Baum firing a shot across Omega's bow.
Right.
But it's them saying, like, hey, you know, we can get into using these very modern, higher tech materials to make a watch that probably will require less fuss over time. You're not going to deal with as much magnetism or wear and tear on the movement.
Right. And, you know, speaking of the movement, you did mention that the Panerai, but the big kind of controversy here is that... another watch that isn't exactly in our wheelhouse, but the Vacheron launched this new 56 line, which is kind of a quote-unquote entry level for Vacheron. I think everybody was pretty clear that they were trying to appeal to kind of a younger generation, bring some new buyers into the Vacheron kind of fold. But the controversy was that the basic automatic Vacheron 56 actually uses a form of that Bowmatic movement without the Geneva seal finishing. And so I think some people feel like that kind of waters down Vacheron. So
it seems outside their game.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think this is also the world in which Richemont is going to play now.
Right.
And I think it's just a question of, you know, if you spend this kind of money to develop a movement,
yeah,
little bits and aspects of the movements will be passed around, and Swatch has been doing it for 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Even longer than that if you want to consider ETA, right?
Right.
As a sort of legacy thing.
Right.
But, you know, Blancpain will have something borrowed liquid metal from here, or, you know, that Omega made, or Omega will have an SI14 balance spring that they got from somebody else. And you know, it's these technologies, and that's the power of having these huge kind of conglomerates.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think in some ways it can backfire on a brand like Vacheron, which has high-end appeal.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I think part of that comes from it standing, specifically standing separate from other brands.
Right.
And maybe with the 56, they figured this isn't going to be for our normal buyer.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think what they're banking on is that it won't alienate their kind of faithful, but they'll make enough by selling it to a new crowd to, you know, maybe... You know, you want to keep a brand viable and make enough money to kind of turn out the high-end stuff that you're known for. So if it works for them, that's great. I hope it does. But yeah, it was kind of a bit of a talking point, I guess, around the show for the basic automatic one.
What did you think of the Bowmatic in person on wrist?
It was beautiful. You know, it's funny because Baume & Mercier, their kind of big showpiece this year was this the Indian motorcycle partnership, and they had a, you know, streamlined, sort of foiled out Indian motorcycle right in the center of their booth. They brought in Burt Munro's grandson and grandnephew, or son and grandnephew from New Zealand, and they were here. He's the guy from that Anthony Hopkins played in the World's Fastest Indian movie a few years back.
Oh, sure, okay.
The Kiwi who set a land speed record in the late 60s on a very old Indian motorcycle. So they had a tribute piece to Burt Munro, and then they had these Clifton Club chronograph Indian pieces, which to me, I kind of wanted to set those aside, and I just wanted to look at the Bowmatic. It was a beautiful watch. It's really fun on the wrist. I mean, I don't see myself spending that kind of money, but you know, for a guy who's looking for, you know, maybe he's going to the office regularly and he needs kind of a nice watch, it's a legit piece. It's not just kind of a throwaway, you know, dress watch. It's something you just buy and don't appreciate for what it is as a watch. And this one is,
right.
It felt really good. Another thing that Balmain Mercy came out with was the, and I can't say it was entirely to my taste, but I don't know if you noticed, and it was a bit underplayed, I guess they didn't highlight it much, was the Clifton Club, they have a quartz collection now.
I didn't see that at all.
So, you know, the Clifton Club last year launched, it's that kind of sort of dive watch looking, you know, with the rotating bezel, kind of the fun straps and that sort of thing. And this year they released a quartz line on bracelet and on strap, and predictably it's lower priced, but they got rid of the rotating bezel. So it's actually a fixed steel bezel with, you know, most of the same kind of dial elements and that sort of thing. And I believe, I could be wrong, I didn't notice off the top of my head here, but I think it's in the $1,100 range for the quartz, which, you know, it's kind of in line for Balmain Mercy. It might be a little expensive for what people want to pay for a quartz watch, but it's handsome. It's nice looking. But the Balmatic was the one to look at that booth, I thought.
Yeah, I thought, the photos that Hodinkee put up and that I saw on Instagram and such of the Balmatic, I thought the dial looked really good, a nice kind of like rich white.
Yeah, yeah.
It had kind of a glassy look to it, and I thought the markers were kind of pretty. It kind of reminded me of the same sort of aesthetic as the Rolex Cellini.
Yes. Yeah,
where it's dressy but not like flashy in any way. It's just kind of like it's one unit of watch that looks very confident.
Yeah,
but it still has some subtelty. And I thought, you know, when I first saw it, I thought like, oh, what's the price going to be? You know, last year, the year before, they had the Shelby titanium chronograph, which was kind of, it was like $7,000 or $6,000.
Yeah.
And then to see this come in at a much more like reasonable price point.
Right.
As far as, you know, just kind of a value statement for the brand, I thought was cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we can jump right over to the 56, which I thought was kind of an interesting line. And I guess you saw all three variants, like there's three movements in the lineup.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the complete calendar looks...
Yeah, that's the one to have. I mean, I think the complete calendar is really cool. And then the... what was the other one they had? Shoot.
There's a complete calendar, a day date, and the automatic.
Right, right. Yeah, the automatic, I mean, just, I think everybody sort of, you know, like I said, it was the controversial piece, but it's also the most accessible, so it's kind of the biggest talking point. But the complete calendar is was kind of the pretty one, I thought. I thought it was the kind of the fun one. And they had sort of completely retooled their booth this year to kind of play off this mid-50s theme, so they mm-hmm. had a lot of sort of jazz albums and kind of low-slung mid-century couches and a big bar.
That's cool.
So they're kind of playing that up. I think it's a real big push for them. Again, trying to reach a new audience. You know, I mean, I think we could talk more about Vacheron, but I think, you know, if we want to kind of stay in our wheelhouse, I mean, I think a good place to move now is to talk about Montblanc, which I think was another highlight.
Cool.
Yeah, a little sort of backstory on Montblanc and kind of where they're headed and what they're all about these days. They brought over Davide Serrato, who was the creative director at Tudor and kind of the man behind the, you know, the uber popular Black Bay series and a lot of their great mm-hmm. watches. And you can start to see his impact now on Montblanc, especially this year, I think. He kind of creates an ecosystem around a theme with their watches. And this year was all about, they were really pushing the sort of spirit of adventure vibe. They had, you know, massive video screen going with sort of drone shots of, you know, mountain peaks or helicopter, you know, views of mountain peaks and the Rockies. And it was all about sort of vintage or historical mountaineering. So they had old ice axes and leather boots around the booth and books about mountaineering. And you could just tell they were really hitting this theme really hard. And they brought in kind of a new look for their 1858 collection, which is kind of probably my favorite line of their watches. You know, the Time Walker's never quite done it for me. And then they've got the Star Collection, which is kind of more of a dress watch series. But the kind of the real talking piece for the show was the 1858 Geosphere, which was a watch that they're sort of spinning as sort of the outdoor adventure watch. And, you know, it comes on a really cool sort of aged-looking light tan Bund style strap, so it's got the pad behind the watch case. It's got a rotating compass bezel, but of course the real centerpiece of the watch is this dual sort of time zone display on the dial that shows the Earth from both the above the North Pole and above the South Pole, and then those rotate in opposite directions to indicate which sort of sections of the Earth are in daylight or at night at a glance. And then there's a second time zone as well as a date. So, you know, just a lot going on. Sort of it really packs a punch movement-wise. It's you know, their in-house thing that we saw, I don't know when it was, a couple of years ago, they had that watch that had kind of a similar function on it, but it was way more expensive. That kind of hemispheres display.
Oh, right. Sure, sure.
And it just kind of it hits the right notes, and it's not a huge watch. I mean, 42 millimeters. It's under $6,000, and you know, it's nice looking. They have a limited version that comes in bronze, which also looked nice. But to me, just the steel watch, you know, Montblanc I think has kind of tried to carve out their space in the Richemont kind of watch universe, and you know, I've often felt in the past like they're kind of been a little heavy-handed and kind of like trying to, you know, force something. And I think in this case, I don't know, it seemed to fit their pricing, their kind of space within the Richemont group, and the watches were really nice looking. So do you care for that?
Yeah, this one's, you know, it's one that I would have to see in person because I'm, you know, I'm not usually crazy about like the faux tanned loom.
Yeah.
That they've used on it, but then it carries over into the two hemispheres. So I think it looks pretty cool, and I think the sizing's pretty neat. I don't think, you know, the bezel, the compass bezel, doesn't, there's not a lot of feature set there for day-to-day use.
Yeah, yeah.
But I do rather like the way it looks, which I don't think I've said about a lot of their lineup before. There's stuff that they've made that's quite striking.
Yeah.
Or, you know, very sporty or very aggressive or, you know, very classic.
Right.
What I would say is that they nailed the pricing.
Yeah, totally.
Because it's a watch with kind of like a weird complication. You get a second time zone, you get these dual hemisphere world time display things, and aesthetically it doesn't look like any other watch.
Right.
And it's not even 13 millimeters thick. It's 42 millimeters wide. You could definitely wear this.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got pictures of it on kind of like a woven fabric strap on this kind of Bund-style NATO or Bund-style leather. And, you know, like you said, it's $6,000. So, I mean, you're looking at the, you know, less than the price of an Explorer and a watch with, you could say, multiple complications or two different, kind of two different display type complications. And I really like that the second time zone, you almost think it's the seconds display.
Right.
But then you realize that it's a 12-hour display and it's just giving you another hour hand, which is quite clever.
Yeah.
And then you have, essentially two more, not easily used as a world time display, but these hemisphere displays, which I guess is more of a novelty or romantic sort of complication.
Yeah. Not exactly useful. I mean,
yeah, I'm not really sure how you would use it. I do think it looks really good.
I mean, do you really need to know who's in daylight and who's at night at a glance? I mean, and it's so small that, you know, you'd have to be able to figure out what the shapes of the continents are. You know, it's kind of tough to do at a glance, but...
For sure.
But yeah, like you said, it's different looking. It's different than anything else out there. And it seemed to really resonate. People just seemed to really like it. The one that I liked was the chronograph in the same series. That was a beautiful watch. Sort of the bi-compacts layout, big registers... 42 millimeters. It has those classic sort of pump pushers, the mushroom shaped pushers, and that was the one that I would probably, you know, personally go for if I were to make a purchase of one of these watches.
Yeah, no, it's also a very handsome looking watch, and again, you have the cathedral hands and a very kind of nice looking traditional sort of design, and looks like the right size, and $4,200 for the price. I mean, they're coming in under a lot of their Richemont siblings.
I couldn't help but think, you know, you mentioned the price. I couldn't help but immediately compare it to that Longines Big Eye that you reviewed not long ago. That came in at what, sub 3,000? I thought
$2,650. It's going to be a sting for a lot of brands.
Yeah,
because I'll be honest, I would lean towards the Longines.
I would too. I would too.
Over the Mont Blanc.
Yeah.
You know, I like I like that Longines went very minimal with the dial text and things like that.
Yeah.
And then of course, you know, I think that they've had the time to show that all 688, the column wheel expression of the 7750,
yeah,
is reliable and can be serviced easily by, you know, anyone who services the Swatch stuff. And
right. Kind of another sort of, I guess, a cool thing about the Mont Blanc theme this year was I went to one of their dinners, I guess it was Monday night, which they had originally said was black tie. So I, you know, stressed and scrambled to accommodate that request. And then I was the only guy in a tux at the whole show. So
oh, really?
I literally was. So I was either, you know, people were saying, oh, you look great. You look like James Bond, or you look like the head waiter, you know? So
well, everybody else was underdressed. Exactly. I mean, like, yeah, that's right. Fair. That's pretty rude of everyone else.
Well, no, because then what happened was when I got here, there was an invitation in my hotel room that had a different dress code on it. So, you know, it was no big deal. But no, with regard to that dinner, I was seated next to our old friend Kenton Cool, the mountaineer that we met at the Bremont townhouse last March.
For sure.
He was a Bremont ambassador. Now he's over with Mont Blanc, and he was literally like just off a plane from Nepal, where he's helping to train a well-known British TV presenter, Ben Fogel, to climb Everest later this year.
Oh wow!
So he was just back. You could tell he was a little frazzled. He was supposed to give a speech, and he was kind of stressed out about that. But he was wearing that Geosphere with a nice suit. Didn't look, you know, properly appropriate, I guess, with a suit, but he pulled it off, and we had a nice chat about mountaineering and his experience, and we talked about, you know, guiding in the Alps, and, you know, just all sorts of stuff. He was just kind of a really cool, kind of laid back guy, good guy to be seated next to at kind of a shishi dinner. So
yeah, we'll have to see if we could get him on at some point.
Yeah, I think
we cross paths at another MB event or something. Have him chat for a few minutes. Yeah. It'd be fun. I think, you know, anyone who's listening, who's, you know, you're sitting there on your phone or whatever, killing time listening to the show, go and follow Kenton on Instagram. I believe it's at Kenton Cool.
Yeah.
And we'll put it in the show notes either way. And he posts stories when he's on these kind of trips.
Yeah.
And a lot of it's these, you know, amazing viewpoints. They'll do some lower climb to acclimatize, and the views are crazy. And he's always looking like he's having just the best time. He seems like a very positive sort of guy.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Which I like.
Yeah. So.
Well, that's rad.
How about Panerai?
Yeah, so two big kind of announcements from them.
Yeah, so yeah, they had kind of the two big ones for them were the Luminor base logo, which brings back what was kind of one of their big releases back in the 90s, kind of one of their first when they first came back on the scene as a legitimate, you know, sort of popular commercial brand. And then they had the Douay 38 millimeter, which was kind of the smallest Panerai that you can get these days. The base logo was, you know, the base logo was the watch that it didn't have the sandwich dial. It has a painted dial, and then of course they use that sort of that P logo at the bottom of the dial, and mm-hmm. and originally they used to use those Unitas hand wound ETA movements with a display case back, and now it's a solid case back, and they're using the in-house P6000 3-day movement, which is an automatic, not a hand wound movement like it used to be, and
right.
White dial, black dial. Sharp watches, you know, I mean, I guess the exciting part of them about it is that the price is good. They're about $4,500 and they're using that in-house movement. But the aesthetics, they look just like the old ones. So, you know, I can't say it's anything groundbreaking here.
And do you know the power reserve on the P6000?
I think that's a 3-day movement. So I think it's...
So, I mean, at $4,500 for a 3-day movement,
yeah,
is excellent. We saw them go to smaller case styles 2 years ago with the white Luminor.
Right.
With some of the blue accents. And I want to say, and I'm fairly certain I'm right with this, it was 11 grand.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, if they're going to begin to approach the types of price points that you and I remember...
Yeah.
From when Panerai kind of turned the corner from being nothing except these things that guys who were really into these old Italian dive watches collected.
Right.
To suddenly being like the hot watch that changed the size of watches for a decade.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then I'm all for it. I don't think I would, I wouldn't scramble to go out to wear a 44 millimeter Panerai. You know, I had a really good time with the small submersible, and I think that's probably where I would lean for a Panerai. I also still have a real soft spot for the Radiomir.
Yeah.
which I think wears its case size a little bit better for someone with a smaller wrist like myself.
Right.
So you can get away with a larger Radiomir in my situation. But $4,500-ish dollars for an in-house Panera, I mean, you're starting to approach the in-house prices of like a Nomos with a date.
Oh, totally.
And if they really want to say like, hey, you know what? If we're going to make a base Panerai, we're going to make it so that someone could aspire to own it.
Yeah.
Not have to be in a situation where they're saying like, well, it costs more than my last car or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
And at something, you know, at half the price, half the retail price of a Submariner.
Yeah.
I think they have a compelling product on their hand. Like I said, it wouldn't be for my wrist. I, you know, 44 millimeters, and especially they're all dial.
Right.
They just don't wear that well for me. But obviously, as true as that statement is, there's also the side where people love 44 millimeter Panerai.
Yeah, yeah.
Have for quite a while, and I don't think that's necessarily going to change.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a compelling watch.
For sure. And the stranger thing would be the 38 millimeter Duo, or Due.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is that like in person? Is the ratio of the strap okay?
It's beautiful.
You know, there's a white and a black dial. I kind of, oddly for me, I gravitated towards the black one.
Yeah. Well, so they had this, I don't know if this is the one you're talking about, but it's sort of this radial finished, it's sort of a dark gray. Is that the one you're thinking of? Or?
Yeah, I only saw two models. One that was kind of a cream,
yeah,
a creamy white. Yeah. And one that was, it looked, you know, roughly black in most photos, but I could tell it had some finishing on it. It wasn't your matte dial like on the base.
Yeah, yeah.
I know Hodinkee published a nice piece on the Luminor Due, the new 38 millimeter steel Luminor. So that's the smallest a Luminor's ever been. And then you're also looking at a $6,000 price point.
Yeah.
Which again, $6,000 in-house and small, Panerai is looking to establish a wider base than the people they've been building watches for the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the funny thing is that my wife really likes the Panerai aesthetic, but it's crazy to think of, you know, a woman with a small wrist pulling off anything that they've made.
For sure.
And so as soon as I saw the 38 millimeter, I had to snap a photo and send it to her, and she was smitten with it just right off the photo. I think it's unusual to see that kind of Luminor aesthetic with the big sort of crown protector,
mm-hmm,
in such a small watch. And it does look a little bit strange, a little bit shrunken. Wow, it's noisy here. But yeah, it really is a neat piece. And that that striking sort of radially finished black or dark kind of smoke gray dial, really beautiful watch. So I think it'll do well, because I think a lot of women like the Panerai aesthetic. And you see women, you know, especially the ones that, you know, work for the brand, you see them wearing the watches, and I always feel bad for them, because I feel like, you know, they're probably supposed to wear their watches and they,
yeah,
just don't,
sure,
quite fit. And at 38 millimeters, it's doable. I think it'll do well in the Asian market. I think guys with smaller wrists, it could work just fine. You know, they showed it on some kind of, I guess, more feminine colored leather straps, and I think if you just swap that out for kind of a cool rustic leather strap, I mean, geez, I'd wear a 38 millimeter, you know, Panerai. I mean, I'm not going to go out and buy one, but I'd love to try it just for kicks, you know.
Yeah, no, I would be definitely game to get one in for a little bit and review it, just on the level of it's strange, right?
Yeah,
not unlike taking a 47 millimeter submersible and making it 42 millimeters,
right. Yeah,
and now you have what's commonly a 44 or 47 millimeter style, and it's 38. I mean, and it's funny because you see them, you know, you go to Panerai's website and they kind of show you all the watches in a grid.
Yeah.
And so the ratio, like the proportions from one watch to another don't really change in the grid. So it's kind of hard to tell. It's really only the kind of size of the text on the dial, of which there isn't that much. It says Luminor, Panerai, and automatic. And
yeah,
then the ratio of the strap width to the lugs.
Yeah.
You can tell that they've kind of massaged that to fit the overall sort of proportions, right, of the watch. I think they did a nice job, at least from the photos I've seen.
Yeah.
But it's weird. And I have to think that this is the kind of watch that will bother a lot of like Paneristes.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Yeah, and you know what's troublesome about it? The only thing that I think you and I are pretty broad-minded. We're not exactly the purists that are going to quibble over a
certainly not when
know,
it comes to Panerai,
a Vacheron or a Panerai or whatever. But you know, to me, the one sticking point for this one for me was the water resistance is quite low. It's 30 meter water resistant on this one, on the Douay 38 millimeter.
just isn't enough for the history of that watch.
Exactly, and with that, you know, kind of rugged crown protector device that, you know, was kind of meant to hold the crown tight for water resistance, it just feels wrong. It feels really wrong. And I think the explanation I heard about that was that you know, that this watch is quite thin. I don't remember the exact proportion, but it's by making it thinner, they couldn't have that beefy 100 meter, 200 meter water resistance that you get on the bigger ones. So,
Well, I mean that might be true. I don't, you know, that's all beyond a 30. It just feels like if you're gonna make a Panerai, a Luminor, it's such a it's such an endeavor in looking at the past of that company to continue that aesthetic, and then to just kind of say like, well, you know, we essentially developed one of the earliest submersible watches, dive watches. And now we're just going to replicate that in aesthetic alone. None of the technical attributes at 30 meters. I mean, again, to bring up that Longines Big Eye doesn't even have a screw down crown. It's 30 meters.
I think somebody pointed out that there's like a I don't know, like a Piaget. I think that super flat one that they showed off this year or something, or one of the skinny Piagets is like 30 meters as well. And they thought, you know, why not? You know, I don't know. To me, it's such a clearly aimed, I don't want to say fashion watch, but it's clearly aimed at you know, just, you know, bringing in new buyers and not appealing to the kind of the history of the brand, like you said.
Well, you've
But
got to assume, and this may be an unfair assumption, and I'm willing to take that on the chin if it is, but you have to assume that people from all these brands have to go to the same general meetings with Richemont, and they see brands like JLC and Baume and Cartier show numbers for men and women. These are, you know, and they have like two bars on their graph. And then Panerai loads up, and they've got one giant bar for men and maybe a sliver for women. And you got to think like, hey, can you guys develop something that could offer the charm, the appeal, but for smaller wrists? And whether that's women or that's an Asian market, that's all doesn't really matter. But you have to assume that they would rather sell to more people. And you're not necessarily just going to create more Panerai fans at this point. Especially with, I mean, these two watches that we're talking about aside, a lot of their watches are quite expensive. And you know, last year they showed a couple very technologically advanced watches, the BMG and like that. And so you have to assume if they're going to offer entry level products that are also smaller, they're just looking to widen the people who might stop and look at them in a store. And
Yeah,
I, you
I have
know,
to, you know, we have to step back from you know, I was having dinner with somebody last night. We were kind of debating these topics about brands, you know, making compromises and things. And I'm like, you know, these guys are in business. They have shareholders. They have money to make. It's a tough business. And I think if you bring in extra people, you have to look past the kind of purists and the old guard and think about somebody like Gashani, my wife, who likes the Luminor aesthetic, but has never been able to wear one. And hey, here now, someone now she can, and you know, she probably can't dive with it, but you know, which is a shame. But you know, it is what it is, you know.
I think that's a great way of looking at it. I think the other way to look at it is if a brand, and this honestly could go for cars or watches or all sorts of things. Like you're like, I really love my MacBook Pro. I don't want to use an iPhone. I don't really want anything else from Apple, but I wish them nothing but success so that they'll keep making the top tier MacBook Pro. And you know, if Panerai needs to make 70 watches to make one or two that I really love, awesome. That's fine. Doesn't bother me at all. And if you can find one watch at every brand that you really like, then how do you get offended when they go in a different direction or they expand their lineup? Like, I understand that there's probably guys who have been with Panerai for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and they just don't understand the brand they see now.
Right.
But also, if they hadn't made these changes, there'd be no Panerai.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, they were down to the, or so the, you know, the classic Sly, Sylvester Stallone rumor that, you know, goes down to, they were down to almost no stock when he rolled into their store in Florence.
Right.
And liked the watches. And if that's true, then you can have, you know, it's a cake and eat it too scenario, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You can have a brand that's this pure expression of what it was before quartz.
Right.
To kind of change the whole world for watches. Or you can have a brand that managed to persist and had to, you know, this is, you know, BMW makes all sorts of things that are partway between a car and a wagon, and I don't like any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But if they need to sell a ton of X6s or X4s or whichever one to keep making the M3 or the M2, then awesome. But keep making them. It's great.
Yeah.
So that's how I see it. And yeah, I like that it's appealing to people who, just like I said in the submersible review, have been benched Panerai fans, really like the aesthetic, aren't going to get on the court with a 44 or 47. So,
yeah.
I say good on them. And if you're deep into Panerai, I think they'll probably continue to make the core models that you really like. And I think you could just cast a blind eye towards the other stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the next one that stands out for me, and we can go quickly because I think this one appeals a little bit more to me than it does to you, but it was one of my favorites from last year, was the Cartier Drive Extra Flat. And of course, last year it was only available in precious metals.
Yeah.
And I remember saying in the meeting, as I'm sure they heard from everyone, I'm not saying that what I said was special, simply that I was probably part of a chorus.
Yeah.
We said like, hey, you know, this would be real sweet in steel. It's super thin. And it's gorgeous, and unlike the rest of the drive, the crystal's very close to the dial because of how thin it is. So the reflections, the crystal's a little flatter than it is on the standard drive or the moon phase, and you don't get as many reflections. And then on top of that, you have a kind of a silvery dial.
Yeah.
No seconds, and then bam, this year they come out with the same thing, but in steel at $5,600 with that Piaget movement.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a beautiful watch. It's like six and a half millimeters high, so it just hugs the wrist. It's just so slim.
It fits so well. It's such a nice shape. Aesthetically, I think it's super legible. I think that if you're in the world of wanting a dress watch, I think this has to be on your list.
Yeah,
because it doesn't look like other dress watches. It doesn't look like a Datejust.
Right.
It doesn't look like a Patek. It looks like its own thing. I love a distinctive element.
Right.
It's super thin, so it's never going to bother you on your wrist. Mm-hmm. And I think that Cartier, at least, and this is maybe me projecting something onto Cartier or me accepting something they've projected to me. I don't know. But Cartier has this ethos of just like, it's class.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that you see it in the tank, and I love the tank, but there's something more youthful about the Drive Extra Flat. And to have it in steel just feels so everyday. And then at $5,600, I mean, like, I'm not going to buy one. I don't need a dress watch. But if I was in that world, I'd be trying to think of a way, like maybe sell a couple and get a drive. Yeah. I just think they're really, really cool. I mean, at that point, you're into the range, like I said earlier, of like a high-end Nomos.
Right.
Is going to start to edge into that price point. Your used Datejust or something else that you could wear to the office, but also wear out to drinks with friends in the evening or to dinner or whatever. I mean, I could gush about that one for a while. I think it's a winner.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, Cartier's always, I've always admired them from a distance, have never really even considered owning one because, you know, the Santos, the Tank, most of their watches just, they're just not the shape. They're just not the aesthetic that appeals to me. Now, this one, that something about, you know, 40 millimeters in that flat of a watch just has this, like, just perfect kind of dimension, the way it sits on the wrist. I think 40 is such a great size for it. And you have that really expansive dial with those big oversized Roman numerals. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a cool watch. I mean,
it's never going to age.
Yeah, yeah.
Not in 30 years. I mean, maybe they won't continue making it like they have the Tank or other models, but that watch will still be cool and classy and stylish whenever. It's just a good design. I love that there's no seconds.
Yeah.
And a solid movement from Piaget for sure. So yeah, we've got only a couple left on the list. You want to jump right into what I think is probably the star of the show, like you had mentioned earlier.
Yeah, let's talk about the Jaeger LeCoultre, the Jaeger, the JLC, whatever you want to call it, the Polaris. I think it was actually my first appointment at the show on Monday morning, and it was a great way to kick off the show. It really set the bar high.
I don't think we would have predicted that they would have topped the impact of the models they put out last year, the Skeleton Hand.
Yeah.
You know, the Sector Dials, as the people like to call them, but I think they did it. At least they made one I want way more.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the past couple of years, they've kind of gone away from the kind of the proper sports watch that for a few years there they had a good run, you know, with the deep sea stuff and you know, even the first the 1958 Geophysic that they came out with, they kind of veered away from that, and I thought, oh, they're leaving sports watches to IWC and to Panerai, and then this year comes out, you know, the Polaris, and it was like such a, you know, just such a breath of fresh air. It was so exciting.
A chronograph, a three-hander with date.
Yeah.
The alarm and a world timer. I think that's, looking at the site, I think that covers all of them, and it ranges from 41 to about 44 millimeters, the world timer at the top, and the no-date three-hander at the bottom. And, I mean, they all look really good.
Yeah.
But that blue three-hander no-date...
Perfect.
...is just...
Yeah.
I mean, it's $6,600 on a leather strap, and you're buying this absolutely stunning. It still has the two crown. The watch is neat. I really love that they didn't go especially vintage, but they also didn't go in any way like hyper modern. It just looks like a JLC.
Which is
like, how did they kind of manage to do that? It has elements of the diver that I like in it, mm-hmm. and even the Navy SEAL with the 12, 3, 6, and 9.
Right.
And then that blue one, I mean, in either color. I think it looks great. The photos were great. What did you think? How do they kind of stand out in person?
Well, when I first, you know, caught wind of a new Polaris, I remembered that a few years back they did the tribute to Polaris. I think it was like a limited edition, really, really high-end expensive thing. And I thought, you know, how can you reinterpret the Polaris? I mean, it's kind of a very specific aesthetic. And they did. And I think you're right. Of course, the Polaris was a Memovox. It was a watch that had an alarm. It had the three crowns. And I thought, you know, I didn't realize when I heard that they were doing this, I thought, oh, they're just going to do another alarm diver limited edition, which of course they did. The halo piece, the $12,600 Memovox limited. But the other ones, like you said, are much more exciting to me. And the reinterpretation they did with just doing a twin crown kind of quote unquote super compressor style watch with those numerals that are just slightly tweaked from, you know, from what we've seen in the past, they're a little more squared off. You know, 41 millimeters for the automatic. It's like, it's just the perfect size. It has the steel case back with that kind of super compressor dive helmet logo on the back, which I don't know, it just pushes all the right buttons. And then I'm not sure if that the three hand automatic is provided with the rubber strap. I'm sure you could get it for it, but the rubber strap they put on the Memovox limited edition and the date version were just this like supple textured sort of almost a tropic style rubber strap.
Yeah, they look great in photos.
Wasn't as keen on the bracelets, but you know, I'm pretty picky about bracelets.
The bracelet's really pretty in photos,
yeah.
But then you go right on the site and it's $1,000 difference.
Yeah,
and probably if you ever plan to resell the watch, it's best to go with the bracelet. But if you look at the site, they put the black and the blue with the bracelet, and then just below it, the black and the blue on these really beautiful looking leather straps.
Yes.
And man, is that a beautiful watch.
Yeah, it is.
It really is like beautiful. Is the blue really good in person? Does it kind of, because it's mixed finishing on the dial to kind of replicate the difference. You know, with the Memovox, you had the central kind of alarm circle.
Yeah.
And they've kind of replicated that across the entire lineup by using different finishing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the blue, I personally, I'd opt for the black. I mean, I'm real picky about kind of blue dial stuff. I think like that Oris Carl Brashear we saw in Colorado had kind of the right sort of matte blue, which is kind of my preference.
Very dark, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to argue with it. I think it was really nice, and on the wrist, it just they all just wore really well.
Oh, I was just going to say, and how do the larger ones wear? The chronograph and the world timer kind of edge out the larger sizing.
I think the 41 millimeter is the one to have. I mean, yeah. I think the bigger ones, you know, they work fine. It's a nice, the aesthetic wears that size well. It's not like a 44 millimeter, you know, Panerai with, you've got this giant crown on the side, but I think the 41 millimeter automatic is just, it just wears well. It's not terribly tall, and just that expansive dial on that kind of diameter watch.
And no
with
date
with no date, it's just so clean.
Yeah
just a superb watch, and like you said, the price for a JLC, it's great. I mean, I think, you know, the theme here, I mean, look at the watches we've talked about: Balmatic at 2790, the Panerai base logo at 4500, and then this coming in between 6600 and 7600. I mean, these aren't kind of right in the TGN wheelhouse, you know, the Oruses and Seikos and things that we normally talk about.
Sure.
But in terms of affordability, you know, we have to remember that SIHH, the HH is haute horlogerie, you know, it's high watchmaking, and that is what most of this stuff is. So in that realm, this is a very good price for a really, really fine watch.
Yeah, and arguably you probably can't buy from a better manufacturer than Jaeger LeCoultre.
Yeah. Like, yeah, that's without a doubt.
Like if you were to rank brands on their current manufacturing capability, their movement prowess, mm-hmm. and their history, you'd have to have JLC at the top of that list.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And you're looking at a really nicely sized. I'm very excited to see it in person. This is definitely my seen unseen sort of armchair SIHH favorite watch.
Yeah,
and this would be the exact sort of watch where if I was in a position where I wanted to, you know, buy my way into a JLC, this would definitely be at the top of my list right now. I think it's just a stunning thing. I've always loved the Deep Sea Chrono, but the price point's quite a bit higher.
Yeah, yeah, so. Yeah. Definitely the star of the show. Definitely the highlight for me. I would say, you know, if we just kind of step back and look at the ones we've talked about, I think, you know, if I were to rank things, I'd put the Polaris at the top. I did like the Mont Blanc 1858 stuff quite
a
bit.
It's a cool piece, yeah.
You know, and every brand kind of this year had something interesting, as is usually the case. But I think last year, the year before, I mean, other than the Master Control stuff from JLC, a lot of it was just a bit ethereal for me. And I think this one just slots right in as just... you know, definitely in my wheelhouse, and I know in your wheelhouse. And so, definitely best of show, I would say, is the Polaris.
And a few others that kind of stood out just for their awesomeness, not necessarily even being able to buy one, even if you had the money on the list. You've got the Resence Type 2 E-Crown Concept. What is that like in person? I love seeing Resence stuff in person.
So... Polaris, definitely my favorite watch of the show. Resence absolutely blew me away. It was the innovation. It was the highlight, the thing that just made my jaw drop when I sat in on that appointment. It was Resence. It's not even a watch that looks good on my wrist. The aesthetic is strange at best. You know, I mean, it's cool. I just find these guys, aside from watchmaking, just the most incredible innovators. And this watch... aside from Resence's normal kind of out-of-the-box thinking, which involves, you know, taking an ETA 2824 movement and, you know, floating it in oil and using, you know, magnetic coupling to kind of turn a series of discs to display the time, that's all well and good. That's all, you know, really cool and cutting edge on its own. The E-Crown concept, they've bumped it up an entirely to a different level with putting kind of a wafer of electromechanical... functionality in this watch that, in a nutshell, what this does is you can actually double tap on the crystal of the watch, and that tells the watch that you are now getting ready to register the correct time, which you can then either set using an app on your phone electromechanically. Little motors will actually turn the mechanical portion of the watch to set the correct time, or you can set it manually using that sort of pivoting I don't know if you don't really call it a crown, but the setting gadget on the back to set it yourself. And then the watch will register the correct time. And then it will check that once a day against, what it, what you told it was the correct time. And if there's been variance from the time you set it to that current time when it's checking, it will actually automatically reset the hands to the correct time once a day. Not only that, the watch has these little shutters, this little sort of arc of shutters on the dial, that when the watch detects that the power reserve is getting low, those will flip open. The power reserve of the electromechanical portion will flip open, and it will solar charge the electrical part of the watch. And
Fantastic.
then the, and then there's also a kinetic winding function. So basically, the kinetic winding function would keep that electromechanical portion topped off if you're wearing the watch, but if you set it off for the weekend or a few days and that runs low, those little shutters will open and allow, sunlight or light to charge it. I mean, it's just,
Wow.
yeah, I mean, wow. I mean, what do you say? I mean, it's just stunning, just incredible innovation.
What a cool thing. I mean, their stuff is always so special to see in person because it feels so foreign but distinct at the same time. Like they have such a solid aesthetic. And then to see, I mean, they came out of nowhere a few years ago,
I know.
and to see them just kind of swing for the fences with stuff like this e-crown concept, I just think it's special to see in person. And I know that like it's a legitimate privilege just to be able to see and handle the Resent stuff, because it's not something that you can go to even a lot of big cities and see. But this is definitely like if I was just listing brands that like if you're ever at a really like wherever they have a store or carried, if you have the opportunity, make it part of your day to see a Resent in person. They're really, really fun. And even if it's something where like it's more than you'd ever spend on a watch, like it is for me, or it's not necessarily your personal aesthetic, it's still really cool and really fun to see in person and to experience and to see the way that the light plays with the oil and the way that, the kind of two pieces of the case, the kind of aquarium-like top structure meets with the back and the strap is integrated. All of it's just it just feels, I don't know. It's hard to explain if you haven't had the chance to see one, and it's something that I always like to see, even just represented on video is fun.
And then, the big one, Lange, is always a favorite.
For sure.
Entirely not anything in my universe that I would probably be ever owning. But this year's Halo piece for them was the triple split, which is the world's first triple split, split seconds, minutes, and hours chronograph. People might remember that for several years they've had a double split, which was the world's first split seconds and minutes chronograph. So you have overlaid sweep hands for both the minute counter and the seconds counter, and now on the hour register as well, you have kind of that coaxial hour display. And you start and stop the chronograph as you normally would, but there's a third button on the case on the left side that when you press it, it will, stop that first set of sweep hands and register that event, that the elapsed time for one event, and the other hands will continue to move and continue to track the elapsed time for a second event up to 12 hours. And it's just fantastic. The typical Lange, just outstanding. It's got kind of this beautiful gray dial with these kind of little touches of color on the power reserve. And it's thick, big, heavy, giant watch. I mean, it's just it's a white gold case, and I think it's 150 grand. It's just an absurd thing,
Yeah,
but
sure, why not?
you gotta, that's it's what it's like, your Bugatti or so, your concept car or something. You have to see it. You have to laugh and just admire what these guys do.
Well, sure. I mean, the turbograph, the perpetual datagraph, all those, they do something like this every year, which is more of a like, hey, look, we can do it. We did it. And it's, otherwise I think there are these kind of things that go to specific collectors and things like that. And I think it's just fun that they exist in the first place and that they kind of swing for the fences with something like that. I mean, it's the same sort of expression of what Resence is doing, just the aesthetic couldn't be different.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or sorry, the aesthetic couldn't be more different. And yeah, so true. You know, long as fun to see from the most basic all the way up to the most extreme.
Right.
Like the way that they do dial balance and date and things like that is just, I mean, it's legendary. Yeah. They make just stunningly beautiful watches. And you with the watches that they make that they intend people to actually wear all the time, mm-hmm. they're surprisingly wearable for precious metal watches. You know, they don't do stuff in steel. And legibility is always very good. And they have kind of a defined aesthetic, especially with stuff like the Longa One. Stunning, just really, really beautiful dress pieces. And it's always a fun meeting to be able to see their stuff. And especially because, again, like with a lot of this, it's just not stuff that you're going to come across at the duty free or unless, right. you know, unless you go to New York City and you go to the right spot and maybe make a phone call beforehand so they know you're coming so they can actually have something. And, you know, a lot of people don't get that opportunity. So it's hard to have to kind of keep that in perspective, just getting a chance to see it, whether it's at an SIHH or a Basel, can be the treat on its own.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing to remember about SIHH is other than the watches that we talked about, which are kind of more commercial pieces, the great majority of what you're seeing there, it's essentially like walking through a big art gallery. I mean,
for sure.
We didn't talk about the majority of the watches there. I mean, you know, Grubel Forsey, we could go on for probably an entire show about. I mean, they do astounding stuff, and Lange and Urwerk and
some amazing stuff from Piaget.
It's really art, you know, and that's what you go to appreciate. And you don't have to pretend that you can even buy this watch and to appreciate it. But you know, one sort of little bookend on this is the, you know, you remember every year in Lange's booth when you walk in, there's this giant, I don't know how tall it is, you know, 20 foot tall watch, you know, enlarged version of
the
Halo watch for the year, and in full recreation of the actual watch in macro. And I found out this year that, you know, that replica, that giant replica, is actually it's actually metal. They actually make all the components.
No way.
Out of somebody said German silver, but then it was
That'd
corrected. I guess they make it out of aluminum,
okay.
And then they actually coat it with German silver, like the bridges.
Whoa.
Can you imagine how heavy that thing is
and what it takes
and the cost?
Yeah. So that's incredible. So for
anybody, isn't that incredible?
Anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, anytime that anyone shows a photo of the booth at SIHH for Lange, there's always a giant watch in the front. And I would say like it is probably 15 feet in cross.
Yeah.
That's probably fair. And it's always whatever their big Halo piece was. So it was a giant triple split this year. I had no idea that they essentially made the watch.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's got to be at, what, 800% or something?
Yeah.
It's just ludicrous.
I mean, I think any other brand would just do it plastic, you know.
Yeah, of course,
Whatever, you know.
But theirs is running and...
Yeah.
Oh man.
So awesome.
I had no idea it was like and then to do the coding and goodness sakes.
Yeah.
What a brand.
Yeah. Well, maybe we put a bow on the SIHH talk.
Yeah, I think so. I think we're running nice and long here. We can go right into final notes if it works for you.
Sure. Yeah, let's do that.
All right. You want to go first?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's sort of related to SIHH. This is something I just found yesterday. I think it was actually just released yesterday. The well-known kind of adventure and commercial photographer, Alex Stroll, who's, you know, worked for a number of, you know, really prestigious clients. He's a, you know, great photographer. Great Instagram feed, by the way. He was commissioned by JLC, JJ LeCoultre, to do a photo shoot and kind of a little video project about the new Polaris. And he calls it the Polaris Project in this video that we're going to link in the show notes. It's on YouTube. And basically what he did is he went to Iceland. And in a way, it sort of reminded me of the Chris Burghardt film that you told us about
last
show.
Under an Arctic Sky.
Under an Arctic Sky. Because it's a lot of the same kind of elements. It's cold water surfing. They're driving through snowstorms and Land Rovers. And then they do some a little bit of free diving at Silfra, which is that dive spot there that it's the deep split between the European and the North American tectonic plates.
For sure.
And Just some neat footage, kind of neat to see the behind the scenes stuff. It's pretty much like a Grey-NATO, full-on Grey-NATO material with all the cool elements, a dive watch and Land Rovers in Iceland and just some great footage. So yeah, check it out. It's called the Polaris Project. It's kind of his behind the scenes video of his work for JLC.
Yeah, and he is a, like you mentioned, an excellent, a must follow Instagram feed. I mean, he's got nearly 2 million followers, so I'm sure a lot of you already follow him, but if not, Alex, STROHL. And I'll put that in the show notes as well, but easy enough to find if you're already holding your phone. So for mine is the first one is a book that I got for Christmas, which I'm sure a lot of you've already gotten. It's A Man and His Watch by Matt Horanek. And I've been really loving it. I've been kind of savoring it, if you will, just reading one or two of the stories at a time instead of just blasting through the full book. But Matt Horanek is, he's a bit of a renaissance man. He does a bunch of different stuff. And I had a really great opportunity last year at the Cartier dinner. I was seated next to him and we had a lovely conversation. He's a very charming guy, a very affable guy. And he put together this really beautiful book that kind of uses watches as the touchstone for people's experiences in life. So he interviews all sorts of interesting people about watches that stand out in their history. So it could be anything from, he's got one of Paul Newman's kids, the watches that Newman had left for his kids, to a watch owned by a famous chef and why it's important and all that kind of thing. And I think a lot of you have probably already heard about the book, and my only suggestion is if you heard about it and you thought, well, that sounds interesting, it's better than interesting. I actually find it fairly charming, and it's a nice thing to kind of sit down and read at the end of the day. The photos are beautiful. The watches are widely varied, which I like quite a bit. It's not all just old Rolexes.
Yeah, I think Adam Kranioz has a G-Shock in there, right?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And yeah, so there's a nice mix, and Matt, I think, did a great job, and the book's like $30 on Amazon, and it's this fairly sizable, like, coffee table sort of book, nice thick book with, again, beautiful photographs, and it's about watches. You should buy it. One of you listening could be the guy that does the next book like this, and we'll buy that one too, so go ahead and support it. I think what Matt did here was interesting, and it's the kind of thing that, like, you might read a magazine or read a site like Hodinkee, and they'll have a story like this once or twice a year, which connects a person's successes and history and personality and life with a watch, a product, but then it's theirs because of it. And I think that's kind of the cornerstone of what we like about watches.
Yeah.
And so I highly, highly recommend A Man and His Watch. And actually you can listen to, an interview that Matt gave with the guys from Worn and Wound as well. I'll throw that in the show notes for their podcast. And he did a good job on that as well, which gives you a little bit more background on the book and kind of his story.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I saw Matt a few times here, and the book is great. And I know he's got some interesting plans for the future, which is all I'll say. But yeah, it's a cool concept and a great book. I've got one. I'd like to give a little shout out to some guys that are doing something similarly eclectic to the Grey-NATO. If you think that talking about backpacks and technical clothing and diving and watches all in the same show is a weird kind of mix, Super Alpine is it's mainly photography, and it combines the elements of kind of alpine sports and beautiful mountain views with high-end cars and automotive kind of ephemera. If you remember James's recommendation of a video a while back on The Last Pass, the Henry Ketchpole.
Oh yeah, One Last Pass.
Where he's driving in the mountains in like an Audi R8.
Yeah, it's an R8 Spider, and I could try 10 times and I wouldn't be able to pronounce the name of that road. Hockenjock. That's as close as I'm going to get. Definitely can't spell it.
Super Alpine is kind of a visual manifestation of that video, kind of that element of driving beautiful cars in a mountain environment and kind of that European alpine vibe that you get in a lot of these mountain towns and these passes and these beautiful old hotels and peaks and ski lifts and that sort of thing. And Anyway, to make a long story short, Super Alpine has now moved from their kind of Tumblr and Instagram environment. They're launching a print magazine called Super Alpine, and they're doing it via Kickstarter. So they're trying to raise funds to print the first issue of the magazine. And sounds like they're having a little bit of a hard time kind of getting the word out to raise money for this. I think an issue of the magazine, I think you pony up 12 or $15 and you get the first issue, and that's what they're looking for. So we'll put a link to the Kickstarter page and go check it out. I think it promises to be good. If it's going to be anything like the stuff they put up on Instagram, just beautiful photography of some great cars and some neat environments. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah, the campaign looks really promising, and I've enjoyed a bunch of their work so far. So I think it's pretty much a no-brainer, especially at that kind of cost. So
yeah.
My last one is another from Will Gadd, and I've definitely had a previous Gadd's Truth post. It's from explore-mag.com, and Will Gadd writes these pieces called Gadd's Truth. It's kind of like a column where he kind of takes a look at an aspect of kind of the outdoor lifestyle or the kind of performance sport lifestyle, and digs in. And this one's called Gadd's Truth, We're All Crazy. And it's kind of about his personal relationship with risk. And it's a nice read. It's not super long. It's not something I'm not going to give away what he kind of comes to. I just think that more people should be reading posts like this. I think it's an interesting look at how you meter the way that you respond to others taking certain risks and the way you take risks. And I really like Will's writing, and I really enjoy these posts. So I'll throw that in the show notes, or you swing by explore-mag.com and check out Gadd's Truth. It's a series. Read them all. They're great.
Yeah, well, cool. Well, I think that wraps it up. It's yeah, your bedtime, and it's time for me to go get some breakfast.
Find some good coffee, maybe.
Yeah, I've got a last free day here in Geneva. I think I might go and maybe check out the Paddock Museum if I've got the time. And
sounds good.
Yeah, maybe grab a last beer and a bad coffee somewhere here, and then pack up to go home. So
super.
Yeah, as always, thanks so much for listening. Hit the show notes for more details, and please do follow us on Instagram. I'm at Jason Heaton. James is at J.E. Stacy, and follow the show if you're not already at The Grenado. If you have any questions for us, please write thegrenado@gmail.com. And please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts. Music throughout the show is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we'll leave you with this quote from the marvelous Orson Welles, who said, "I have always been more interested in experiment than in accomplishment."